Welcome back to Stand-Up Comedy Secrets for Beginners. I'm Ron Temple, and I'm here again with leading stand-up comedy expert Steve Roy. Steve, we were talking before the show, and you said you had a few more things you wanted to share about stand-up comedy open mic night. You ready to share?
There's really kind of a lot when you consider that stand-up comedy open mic nights are where the vast majority of people start their stand-up comedy adventures. So I wanted to talk a little bit about open mic availability, and that usually is relative to the population of an area. To put that into perspective, the bigger area you're in, the more open mic opportunities there tends to be. The smaller the area you're in, the less open mic opportunities there tends to be. Like, for example, in New York and LA, there are folks that can find open mic nights and perform anywhere from 2 to 3, possibly more times per week. Those types of opportunities are not as available in smaller areas. You know, in Dallas, you might be able to do an open mic night, once a week. For example, I don't know. I don't have the exact figures for any one particular area. What I'm just saying is for individuals that are in lesser populated areas may need to travel more to get that initial stage time that they need.
Now, you use Dallas, though, as an example. That's kind of a big city. They probably have some availability. The trick is to find the availability. There's a part of it that says you need to know where it is happening. If you really want to perform, right?
Well, not all open mic nights are necessarily at a comedy club. They can be in coffee houses. They can be in restaurants. They can be in any number of areas. It just depends on the locality. It's just different everywhere. I mean, it's different from San Diego than it is in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Or it's different in Cincinnati, Ohio, than it is in Little Rock, Arkansas. You kind of get where I'm coming from?
Right. Is that something a stand-up, you know, a beginning stand-up needs to know, though? They really do need to know where it's...
Well, I mean, that's your bread and butter, is getting stage time. I mean, there's a lot you can do before you step on the stage to be prepared to deliver a high-level act. But you've got to ultimately have that stage time in order to test your materials, test your stand-up comedy material, so to speak. I mean, think of it this way. When you go into a shoe store, you don't just grab the size off the rack that you think is good and walk out. Because if you do, there's a good chance there's a lot of things that you don't know. Are you with me? You need to try them on. You need to see if they fit. If they don't fit right, then you need to get another size. If they fit right, but they still hurt the sides of your feet, then you need to go for a different shoe.
Right.
Well, so the same thing with open mic nights, you know. That's how you see what part of your comedy material is doing what it's supposed to do and what part of your comedy, what part of your stand-up comedy material needs to be adjusted, needs to be refined. Maybe it needs to just go away completely.
Yeah, and I think we've talked pretty a lot actually on trying to develop and tightening your material.
Sure.
I know we're going to talk more about that, but open mic is a way to do that, actually, to deliver it and tighten it for your audience.
Well, right? I'll just tell you the last thing that you want to do as a comedian is use open mic performances as your rehearsal time. If you wait until you get on stage before you ever rehearsed any of this stuff, I'm just going to tell you, that's a formula for disaster right there. And that's what most people do. The only time that they rehearse the only time they rehearse is when they get on stage, and that's too late.
So they should, and I think that's what we've spoke about in the past, was they have to be prepared when they get up in front of that audience, no matter when it is. And if they know they're prepared, and then they're not getting the laughs that they expect, they have to tighten or fix the material. But if they're just rehearsing, they don't know it worked or didn't work.
Well, keep this in mind, too, and this is for those who are looking at jumping into open mic nights. There's usually two halves to an open mic night. There's the first half where the more experienced comics, the new comedians that can get the laughs, they tend to get those first half spots. You have the bigger audiences. They want to entertain those bigger audiences. And then in the second half comes all the people that are brand new, don't know what they're doing, and typically aren't going to do well at all. I mean, it's kind of a known fact, if you get what I'm saying.
No, I do, yeah.
You know, so they don't get the best time. And what happens is once you get a string of comedians that don't do well on stage, the audience tends to thin. for lack of better terms. So by the time a new comedian gets on, there may only be two or three people in the audience. And that doesn't make for much of an audience. Still, I wish someone had told me how important this is to use that time, even if there's just a tiny audience there. Oh my goodness. I mean, that's one of the big mistakes a lot of comedians make is they see there's a tiny audience. They already determine that they're not going to do well, when in reality, they can use that time to their advantage to develop their sea legs, so to speak. You know what that means, right?
I do.
Yeah. To get familiar with the stage, to get familiar with talking in the microphone, to get familiar with the room, to look at the people when they're delivering their material, to be prepared. And I'm going to tell you, you need to be prepared anytime you stand in a public arena, especially as a comedian, when you're up there and the expectation is that you're going to get laughs. You've just got to be prepared. Now, I have a little story about this. It's kind of cool. It has to do with comedian Paul Rodriguez. Keep in mind that this was in 1984, when the stand-up comedy boom was just raging at the time, before a number of factors caused that to go away. But Paul Rodriguez, and just so that people know, this information that I'm relaying right now is in a killer book that I originally got as a new comedian. It was called Comic Lives by Betsy Borns. An outstanding book. I got it, lent it to somebody who didn't give it back. I know that's never happened to anybody except for me. Yeah. And so I tried to order it again and it went out of print. And I was like, oh my goodness. It took me several years to actually find a copy of it and it came back into print. It's just an outstanding book. And really, it's called Comic Lives by Betsy Borns. And it covers a lot of comedians that went on to great fame and fortune. But it talks about their time before they went on to great fame and fortune and some of the nonsense that they dealt with and these kinds of things. Well, there's a story in there about Paul Rodriguez and it talks about how he was a new comedian at the Comedy Store in LA and that he was in the lower third of the new comedians. That's a nice way to say he was awful. He was just completely awful. And just so happens he was performing his open mic night performance and there was a producer who saw him. And he ended up getting cast for a show that only lasted 6 episodes. It was called AKA Pablo. And so he got 6 episodes in a sitcom that went on TV.
And he got that even though he sucked on stage at the time.
Yeah, because he had a look, he had an attitude, he had a style. And this is something that people will look for in New York and LA when it comes to comedians. They'll look at what they're doing and do they fit into a certain character or whatnot that they needed. And keep in mind, at the time, there was a minimal Latino presence in the early 80s. It wasn't like it is today.
Correct.
Yeah. You know, so the timing was right. He got those 6 episodes. And it got canceled. As a matter of fact, it's that particular show was listed as one of the top 100 worst shows ever. But here's the amazing thing. He did those six episodes and for the next 2 years turned down headliner gig after headliner gig after headliner gig because he couldn't do it. He didn't have the time. His material wasn't good enough. And he struggled. He really struggled for 2 years and finally got enough material to be able to go out and do a decent act. But the point I want to make.
Yeah, I think that's what I was going to go into. The point is he had the show gave him the resume to go on to headline, but he knew he wasn't ready for headline stuff.
Oh, he wasn't anywhere close. He knew it. I mean, at least he was smart enough to know it because he would have went out and just sucked and sucked and sucked.
Right.
And this was what was revealed in the book. And it's just such an important thing to realize. It doesn't matter where you're at. It doesn't matter what open mic it is. You never know who's going to be in the room that can see you. And even, you know, there's people that pop in and out of these things, and there may be only two or three or five or six audience members there, but they see who's on the stage and they can see what they're doing. And they can see just like the rest of the audience, if they're prepared and they were ready to go with their stand-up comedy stuff or they weren't, whether they can get the big laughs or not. We talked about this already, about there being this group dynamic environment that really has an impact on a comedian's ability.
Right, and small group, then you're just delivering your material.
Well, if it's too small of an audience, if it's just two or three people. Now, I can tell you, when I was doing traffic school, like I developed my material in traffic school, there were times when I had 5, 6, 7 people in there. I didn't care. It didn't matter. They still were going to get the same thing I was going to deliver to 40 people, which is the maximum amount of folks. And I had done those too. It didn't matter. And I could still grab those small audiences. I wasn't intimidated by the fact that there was a small audience there. But the important thing I want to bring up about this open mic night is you don't know who's there. It brings me to an interesting comment that someone made to me, a comedian, professional comedian made to me, and it went like this. He goes, "I feel so sorry for comedians who start out in L.A. or New York because production people, entertainment professionals, and those kinds of things get to see these people suck for a long time, and it's a hard to get over that, even if you do get to the point where you're killing."
It's kind of the first impression.
Yeah, exactly. You don't get a second chance at a first impression.
Right.
So another thing about comedy open mic nights that I think is really exciting, it's exciting to me if you take it in the right perspective, is if you will go out and check out from beginning to end the comedy open mic nights and write down each of the people, each of the comedians that got on stage, And grade them with, you know, 1 means that they didn't do well and 5 means that they just blew it out. And if you go through several of these, you will see that there is actually very minimal competition there. Even though when you get involved, it can be hard to get time to sign up because there's always more people signing up or trying to get stage time than ever get the stage time. There's always more people that think they've got it all dialed in. So you've got to combat with that. But when you actually look at where the rubber meets the road and see for yourself what these people can do, you'll find that there's only a handful of people that can actually deliver the goods. Yeah. And I'm not just making this up. People need to verify what I'm saying for themselves. But you had said that you had been to comedy open mic nights before.
Yeah, many times.
Uh-huh.
Especially following you around. And I always seemed to be embarrassed for the comedian because you knew they were putting some of their heart and soul into it and they just suck. You know, they just couldn't deliver. For many, many reasons. I think one of them we've learned is they were using us for rehearsal and not, and not actual show.
Not prepared in advance.
Yeah, not prepared well enough.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah, there's always going to be a couple people that just don't have comedy talent, and until brain transplant surgery becomes really affordable, you're not going to see much change in that. There's a couple of people that just, man, their material is awful, their sense of humor is awful. Somehow they think that they can learn to have a better sense of humor, and like I said, and we're a ways from that brain transplant thing. So that's a couple people. But most people that make the decision to get on stage as a comedian have more than enough comedy talent. They have more than enough. They just don't know how to use it. They don't know how to capture it. They don't know how to take what they can do in everyday life and transform it into something that's just a killer on the stage.
Well, and I think that's what I saw. I saw some young comics that you could tell were talented. They were funny. They had some. They had a great look. I mean, there was something about them you knew, but then they delivered the material, and it just wouldn't hit. It wouldn't kill, as you say. It wouldn't. You couldn't get the laughs. And you knew that at one point, if they keep this up or figure out what they're doing right and keep doing that and quit doing what they're doing wrong, that they're going to be. They end up maybe being good or great if they keep it up. So,
well,
yeah,
it's
again,
like I had said before, it's all about their process. Every comedian comes armed to the stage with the process that they use. And if their process doesn't work well, then they're going to get less than optimal results.
We saw a lot of the young comics, or I don't say young, I just say the young in the business that brought in some very, you know, humor that's funny, but it's humor that it doesn't have a lot of backbone. You know, the fart jokes, the booger jokes, so on.
Yeah, you always get some of that. There are people that just, the way they interpret stand-up comedy is, it's somewhat amazing to me. The way I like to describe it is, I'll ask you a question. Have you ever driven with someone who is the nicest, most kindest, respectful kind of person, then they get into a car as a driver and you're the passenger, and then they turn into Frankenstein?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, it's like they're a whole completely different person. You don't ever want to drive with them. You might not even want to talk with them again. I mean, it doesn't matter who they are. It's just like, oh my God, this was death waiting to happen. They just turned into this completely different individual. And that's happened to me a half a dozen times probably, where I got into a car and the person I was with was not the person that ended up behind the wheel. You know, not the person I knew. And there was somebody else there. Well, people do that same thing in stand-up comedy, man. They use their sense of humor naturally at work. They use it naturally with their friends and family. But you mention the word comedy, and man, they turn into this sexist, racist, it's all penis and vagina stuff. That's it. I mean, it's like comedy is the trigger that turned them into this something. I don't know what that something is. And then they get on stage, and some of these people will hit the juvenile thing. The fart jokes and the poop jokes and my dog, you know, left a load in the neighbor's yard jokes. Just, it's just amazing. And they just don't realize that they don't have to resort to any of that. They don't have to turn back into a high schooler to do this stand-up comedy thing.
But they do get a few laughs from it, and I think that they're encouraged then by it, right?
Well, here's the thing. You know, there are comedians that can get laughs. They're nervous laughs. And nervous laughs don't last very long. That's an expression of embarrassment from the audience. And the comedian doesn't know. They think they're killing. They don't understand what a high-quality laugh is. That all they know is that if they say something that's blue or rude or socially unacceptable, that there's a certain amount of people that'll laugh. But they won't laugh at a high level. And there's this restraint, because now you got to take a look at where the audience is at on this. If they laugh at what you're saying, then that means they agree with you. Remember we had said before that laughter is the shared response, saying, I understand what you're saying. You know, I agree with you, and I'm responding to the way that you approach this. Well, if an audience just laughs uncontrollably at this just rude, crude, bestiality, whatever it is, then they're saying, oh, yeah, I totally relate to that. Well, a lot of the audiences don't want to relate to that, really. So it's just an expression of embarrassment, you know.
That's what you meant by nervous laughter. It's just kind of almost, it's what I felt that quite often was embarrassed for him.
Yeah, and the thing about it is that that's really not going to get you very far either, because comedy professionals, agents, promoters, talent bookers, they know the difference between solid, big laughs and what we've just been talking about. They completely know the difference. That's what I'm going to tell you. You know, another thing I will tell you, and we'll go back to the open mic night thing, is simply racking up open mic night performances is not enough to make headway. I mean, you've got to show progress. You've got to demonstrate that you can do what you're up there to do. I mean, I've had people contact me and say, you know, hey, I've done over 100 open mic night performances. What do I need to do to get ahead? And immediately I know what they're telling me is I've sucked 100 times. When's the big thing coming for me? What do I need to do? And I'm, you know, I can't do anything with that.
Well, isn't one of the progress, I think that's what I'm hearing, that they, one of the progressions in stand up is you start getting the earlier times in open mic night. The earlier times in open mic night is what you want. Not the headliner stuff, right?
Well, I mean, that's what you're gonna that's where you're gonna progress to is the better times. That's one of the first that's one of the first indicators that you're grabbing attention. You're gonna get a better time.
I think that's what I'm asking is the better times for open mic night is the earlier times when you still had the greater audience, right?
Sure, and then beyond that is to actually get a gig,
and the gigs become the opening act, the MC.
Exactly. Those beginning.
Go through that progression again real quick. So open mic night, totally different than the actual gig. Because open mic, you want that earlier time. You want the audience when they're fresh.
Well, just keep in mind, when it's a gig, it's for real. You know, it's one of those things where you're going to get paid. Then they're going to put together the most professional show that they can. They should. Whoever's doing the promoting or setting up the gig or whatnot. So those folks who do well at open mic nights can be tapped to be an opener or to do 5 or 6 minutes on a show that someone else has put on. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's what I meant. So when you, one of the, like your first gigs is like you're the opening act. You're kind of the warm up act for the really big stars, but remember.
No. Oh. And now you're talking about something completely different because.
All right. Okay.
And let me just stop you right here. If you're opening for one of the big stars, big comedy stars, you're opening for a band, you're already a headliner, dude. They won't touch opening acts and feature acts for that kind of thing as a general rule. No, dude, they're able to tap experienced headliners that can deliver the goods.
All right. Well, that was good to know because I was thinking maybe that was what you're looking for is that first paid gig would be like an opener. But that's actually you are truly a comedian at that point. Really, you're a paid professional.
The minute that you start getting paid, you can consider yourself a professional comedian.
There we go.
And it doesn't matter if you get $20. It doesn't matter if somebody's willing to pay you anything for what you're doing, it just goes up from there. And like I said, the better you are and the more material you can deliver at a high level, the faster you move in this business.
That's the whole purpose of this series is to give somebody a process, or I should say your books are basically give them a process that will help them progress faster because they'll know what they're doing quickly.
Absolutely. If they've got comedy talent and they're not stuck in trying to write jokes from a blank piece of paper, if they're willing to use their sense of humor and they can trust in that sense of humor, well, then absolutely. I want people to move quickly. It's not comfortable to suck on stage. And we're going to talk about some other things, like, such as stage fright, which is, I want to do that one in the next episode. But that has an impact too. But it's all these things combined, this being able to deliver the goods, having the time that you need for the gig. You know, open mic performances usually are 3 to 5 minutes. That's what you get, depending upon how many people are signed up. And you get 3 to 5 minutes. Now, in the first half of the show, there are people that can get 5 minutes, 6 minutes, 7 minutes, depending upon how well they do. So there's another incentive to do well at open mic nights, because that's how you start developing your 10-minute, 15-minute, 20-minute, 30-minute, 45-minute bits, you know, so that you can get up and entertain audiences for longer and longer periods of time.
And that's that, back to that, moving kind of into the front of the line in open mic night. Now, the other thing I think we've talked about on open mic nights is that you start becoming recognized as funny. That's what starts happening. So when you do show up to sign up, or there's a good chance that the comedy, let's say Wednesday night has become the night you usually are there, they're waiting for you to show up again, correct?
Well, I don't know that I would characterize it like that. I will tell you what I've seen. I've been at open mic nights when, and it wasn't me, another comedian got on stage and was slaying the room, and watched the manager literally jump out of their chair and run to the showroom to see what was going on.
Okay, yeah. In other words, they're sitting back there, and they just hear the laughs. They don't see the guy.
That's exactly right. They don't know who's up there. It's a cattle call. Yeah. And it's a complete cattle call.
They go, whoa, something's happening.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's when you start to draw attention, is when you start getting those laughs, and especially with small audiences, man. If you can nail a small audience, you're the king or queen. And I mean that in all three genders.
Okay.
I think that's the politically correct thing to say now.
I think you got pretty close, but I'm sure we'll get a call or two.
Well, you know what I mean, dude.
I'm hoping somebody else does too. Okay. All right, let's not so much switch topics, but let's move over to something a little different. Let's talk about different types of stand-up comedy material.
Sure. There's basically four broad groups of stand-up comedy material. There's the delivery types, and that's the 1 and 2 line jokes versus topic-based or storytelling stand-up comedy. And then the other two are, there's clean and everything else. Clean stand-up comedy material and everything else. Those are the four main groups. So I'll talk a little bit about the 1 and 2 line joke thing. That's reminiscent of your Henny Youngman, Rodney Dangerfield. Newer comedians that do that kind of thing exclusively. The latest one I can remember that comes to mind is a guy named Mitch Hedberg. And he's passed away now. But that's the old school, old timey, you know, hey-ya, hit 'em, kabang, that kind of stuff. Now, I read an article about Stephen Wright. Now, there you go. There's a great example of a 1-2 line joke comedian.
He's who came to mind when you said that. It was Stephen.
Yeah, Stephen Wright. Okay. I read something that said he needed to have 360 jokes in order to perform an hour on stage. Think about that. And you know how most of his stuff is, it's just esoteric. It's just one single thought with a punchline, next single thought and the punchline, next single. You know what I'm saying? I mean, yeah.
slow to deliver, and he pulled it off so well.
And yeah, exactly. And the thing about it is, and that's your typical one and two line joke situation. And man, I have the greatest respect for people that can pull that off, because that is the absolute hardest way, the hardest type of material to do. I couldn't do it. I couldn't tell anybody how to begin to start doing that one and two line thing. And then there's topic based stand up comedy material. That's my forte. And that's where you're on a subject, you're on a topic, you're on talking about an experience, an observation, someone else you know, something that happened to them. And when you're dealing with topic-based stand-up comedy material, man, you can produce minutes of stand-up comedy material from just one thing. And that's how my material was. I mean, I wouldn't spend the time working on a joke. To me, that's a joke.
Well, I just got back from a weekend with my brother. And you know, it's kind of one of those things we tell everybody, don't laugh when he's talking, because it just encourages him. But what he does is exactly that. It's a topic. He picks a topic that he wants to tell a story about, and then he makes it just so goddamn funny. I don't even know if he could ever repeat that story. But it's a topic. It's just something that happened in his life that he wants to share, and he shares it in a very humorous way. So it's really natural for him. And, of course, I laugh. God, I wish I didn't, but I do. I encourage the beast. But he really does. It's topic-based. That's kind of what we all have a little bit. It's almost natural, isn't it? Somewhat natural, topic-based.
Oh, absolutely. It's what we've been talking about this whole series, about getting on a roll, talking about something you're familiar with, relaying a story from your past, and getting on a roll. This is what we've been talking about. The main advantage that I see over topic-based material, over the one-line, two-line joke thing is you're not starting over every time. Once you're on a topic and you've got it set up, you know, you could say anything. You could say, you know, I shop at Walmart. I'll admit that, you know. I'm not going to tell you what pajama bottoms I wear when I go down there, but I go down there, and now here you go. You've just started talking about shopping at Walmart. Okay? I'm going to say that probably 95% of the population is going to know what shopping in Walmart is like.
Yeah.
Okay? And so whatever you say, now it's all set up. It's all set up. Now all you got to do is talk. It's just brief setup, punchline, 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 setup, punchline. You're already on the topic. You don't have to start over, all over again, until you get to your next bit. See, that's the thing. I would work on stuff, and if I couldn't get 2 or 3 minutes out of what I was working on, it wasn't worth my time. I just wouldn't fool with it, because it's just too easy, and the punchlines come quicker. And, man, you want to talk about getting on a roll. It's easier to get on a roll.
Yeah, and again, as an instructor, as a teacher, I do realize that's my role, is that when I get on the humorous side of whatever topic I'm speaking on, it becomes really easy, because it's a topic. You're right. I've already set it up. The topic's there, and now I can even call it back later. I can put out the material I have to put out, and 20, 30 minutes later, I can call it back in and actually start again.
Sure,
and
sure.
Continue the role.
Absolutely, provided the initial material killed. And we had talked about that before, but
don't hold back the bad stuff. Yeah, I found that out too.
Well, you know, I told you, when we were talking before the show, I had told you about Ken Groves, my friend Ken Groves, who had told me about a comedian, headliner level comedian, that he had met, and the guy does 45 minutes on farting. Now, here's the deal. Never says the word fart, pass gas, cut cheese, ever in 45 minutes. and everybody knows what he's doing right from the beginning. And he starts his act out like this. He says, have you ever walked into an elevator and you need to relieve a little pain? And he puts his hand on his tummy. And he goes, and just as soon as you relieve that pain, somebody walks in. Now, everybody knows what's being talked about. All he's got to do is, you know, they walk in and go, oh, man, somebody died in here, or whatever. So everybody knows what he's talking about. And for 45 minutes, he has all this material all about this without ever saying the word.
So it even makes that much funnier.
Oh, absolutely. But what I'm saying is that gives you an idea of the power of a topic that you can run with. If you know what you're doing, if you know how to structure and develop an act that's based on you, who you are, what makes you funny now, how you talk, how you think, what you think is funny, and all these other factors, if you can put it all together and you know how to structure it, you can be a force to be reckoned with. There's no doubt about it.
Well, I think we saw that with you, and we've got to talk a little bit about you and your progression. But some of the things that you tried to get to move away from, your accent and things like that, it really did. Once you realized that's who you were and you used it in your act, it worked for you.
Oh, yeah. And it worked whether I was fat, which I started out kind of fat, and then I got divorced, and then I got really thin, more handsomer and taller, too. And then I got married again and went back and got fat. So, I mean, and it still worked. It all worked. It didn't matter. It didn't matter about my accent. It didn't matter if I was thin or fat. It didn't matter. It wasn't about that.
It just became you, and you made it funny.
Well, my act was me. It was me and my sense of humor and the things that I found amazing, fascinating, thrilling, horrible, or whatever it is that I want to talk about. So,
I think that's what we've been saying all along. If you want to progress quickly, you got to find you. You got to find yourself in this, right?
Yes, and that's why I say that this trying to produce one and two line jokes is the hardest way, because not only if you can do that out of thin air, if you can do this one or two line jokes out of thin air, then you have no mental connection to this material. It's just words on paper. Even if you can do it and it works, now you've got to do that 4 to 6 times every minute. And now you've got to memorize 4 to 6 jokes for each minute. You get what I'm saying? That's why I was referring to the Stephen Wright being just phenomenal as far as the work he has to put into this, because he has to memorize 360 jokes.
Now, I haven't seen him in a while, so I don't know what he's done in life. I haven't seen him on TV or any shows, so I don't know if he went that direction. But I'm going to pick on Stephen Wright for a second. His act, that's a hard act. Like, as we've said, that's hard to keep doing that. Do we know what's become of him?
He's still performing stand up just like, Brian Regan. He hasn't, gotten any TV shows or anything like that. I mean, he's definitely done the Tonight Show and those kinds of programs, but he hasn't broken into any kind of TV shows and that kind of stuff. Stephen Wright did a little bit, but those guys focus on their stand up. That's where their strengths are.
And stand up, you can make a living. And so that's what you're saying with Stephen Wright and Brian Regan and some of these comics, that if you're not actually involved in comedy, you probably don't even know who they are. But they're out there making a living.
Well, this leads right into this other aspect that I was going to talk about. I talked about one line and two line jokes versus topic based stand up comedy material, which is what I show people how to work with. But there's clean and not clean stand up comedy material. And when I say not clean, I mean, it can be any variants pass clean. The reason I bring this up, and I don't tell people what kind of stand-up comedy material to develop. That's not my job. That's really the artist's preference, and I stand by that. What I will tell you is it doesn't matter what kind of act that you want to develop, whether it's clean or you want to develop a rated XXX act, doesn't matter. If you can't get 4 to 6 good laughs, quality laughs every minute, you're not going to go anywhere. It doesn't matter. The reason I tend to talk about developing a clean act is because there's just so many more performing opportunities, and there's many more performing opportunities, many more money-making opportunities. The money is can be much bigger than what you can get in the comedy club market. So, which, you know, if you're just doing stuff that's only good for the comedy club market, you know, rated R, rated X material, it pretty much eliminates a comedian from doing some of the cleaner stuff that pays big money. I mean, it pays big money. I mean, I think we talked about this in the college market. Those folks start out anywhere from $800 to $1,200 bucks a show. You know, they pretty much need to be clean. New comedians starting out on cruise ships, $1,500 bucks a show. That's for 45 minutes, dude. I know, I did that. I lived that. And so, you know, the corporate gigs, they can pay thousands of dollars when you're only getting $200 for the same act in a comedy club environment. So that's why I talk about clean material. I'm not trying to force people to go into one way or another, but I mean, at some point, income's going to come into the picture.
Right, and if you're trying to make a living at that, it's better to develop it clean and have a dirty side to it, right? If you want a little bit more of an adult, edgy show, clean can become adult and edgy.
Well, I'll just use my own act, for example. I would use some profanity in my comedy club act. It was natural. It was easy for me. When I did corporate work, I did the same act, just without the profanity. But I always develop my material clean first. You can always add profanity. You just can't take it away if that's the crux.
That's what makes it funny.
That's exactly right. You can't.
If the punchline is blue, then you gotta.
Well, the best way that this has been put is, you can make a clean act blue, but you can't take a blue act and make it clean. It just doesn't work the other way around.
Right.
And this is one of the reasons why I was able to get the kind of work that I got without not one single TV credit. I didn't have an agent, didn't have a manager, none of that stuff. Nothing. But man, I'll tell you what, I got work and work and work, and I worked every month for years, years and years. And that's because my material was clean. And I think that's important for people to know when they first start out, because here's the thing. Success is a habit. Will you agree?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So if a new comedian has the habit of developing blue material, that's going to be more difficult to change than if they started doing clean material.
And if you didn't hear one of our earlier episodes, blue just means edgy, adult, profane. Okay, so blue is taking us to the next level. I wanted, you know, part of what I was going to ask you earlier, and I'll bring it up now, is that there are some comics that we think of as just dirty. They get on and they are edgy at best. Richard Pryor is one of those. Can we talk a little bit about?
Sure. This is a great one to bring up, because Richard Pryor, when he did Live on Sunset Strip, people got a hold of that, watched it, got the tape, watched it, and they saw Richard Pryor use profanity. That's what they saw. And they equated his profanity in his act as what made him funny. And dude, this has gone on for decades now, decades, literally, where comedians, new comedians, think that using profanity is the key. That's the funny. They missed what Richard Pryor was talking about. The profanity he used in his stand-up comedy act was like icing on a cake. It wasn't the cake. And this is the problem new comedians have, is they think that profanity is the key and doesn't get them the laugh that they want, and they can't figure out why. Well, you've got to have the cake. You can't just go up there with the icing and expect it to sell it as a cake.
And he had the cake. He was one funny guy.
Oh, he talked about major. He talked about major issues, racial issues, relationship issues, and those types of things. Oh man, he talked about drug issues, and very, very candidly, very openly. But if you only saw the profanity, then you missed it. And there's plenty of people that miss it all the time. Same thing with Robert Schimmel. Do you know who Robert Schimmel is?
No.
He was a R to X rated comedian. And he was funny man. But it wasn't just the profanity that made that man funny. Just like Sam Kinison, it wasn't profanity that made that man funny. It was what he had to say. Profanity was icing. It wasn't the cake. These people delivered the cake. Chris Rock, he's a good one. Okay, he talks about pretty darn edgy stuff, racial things. He's a really brilliant comedian. I've seen him perform live. Does he use profanity? You bet he does. But I know that there's people sitting out there going, I could do this, and all he does is just use profanity. And so I could do that and be funny. I could get famous. Woo!
But we've seen, here's the nice thing about Chris Rock, is we've seen him funny clean. When he's doing interviews with Oprah and doing interviews
just
as funny clean.
I'm going to come back to this. You can't get on The Tonight Show, The Jimmy Fallon Show, any late night show. You can't get on any of those shows and do a dirty act.
That's true.
not a one. So
censorship, yeah.
Oh, and just so that you know, it's funny you should bring this up because this is a very interesting thing to me. If you get selected to go on to The Tonight Show or any of these late night shows, you have to provide them with a word-for-word transcript of what you're going to say exactly. And they've got to approve every single word before you go on. Now, once that process gets done, because it's normally a process because people put in stuff that they can't do, and so they got to add more material and that kind of stuff. Well, guess what? If you go on and you don't do exactly what was approved, you're toast. You are absolute toast.
So if you go on a live show, your nerves get the better of you, and you start to ad-lib, you don't get invited back.
Well, the thing about it is all those late-night shows are pre-recorded. You know,
oh, okay.
You know, so that there's... But I'm just saying, if you deviate from what you do, what you was approved, and you go off into left field, you're done. You're toast. You're not coming back.
Okay, so do what you say you're going to do.
that answered a couple questions here. Does your comedy, stand-up comedy material need to be written down? Yes, it needs to be written down. Yeah. It'd be good to have it written down always. And you may not perform it word for word, but keep in mind, your written stand-up comedy material is your map. That is your roadmap. And you need to be able to follow that, and especially if you're going to look towards TV. Now, keep in mind, I was talking about the late night shows. I wasn't talking about, these multiple comedians on Showtime where they do stand-up comedy specials, or Comedy Central, where they've got multiple comedians doing, you know, 8 minutes or whatever it is they do. Gotham City Comedy or whatever's on TV, that's a little different thing. Matter of fact, Gotham City, they don't edit anything. I mean, I've heard everything on that show.
It's cable, though. They're not. They're
well,
not
that's right. That's exactly right. It's cable. That's different. But that's different than mainstream, big network, late night TV.
And we'll use Chris Rock again. If Chris Rock's act had to come on to Oprah the way it is played out on cable, Oprah wouldn't have him on.
Well, I don't think I've seen Chris Rock perform on Oprah, but I'm just saying you nailed it right on the head. So the big thing that I want to illustrate here is that, or underline here, is that clean is mean. Let me just tell you, clean is mean. You can always do your edgier stuff in the comedy club market, but if you want to work outside that market, man, you've got to be able to develop and deliver a clean stand-up comedy act. And let me tell you, there are people out there that just nail it. And I'm going to tell you to what extent. I was invited to do the training in, it was 2004, 2005, the first time that I did the Christian Comedy Association training. And I had never been to this before. I didn't even know they existed till they approached me. And I didn't find out until I was there that most everybody had my stuff. It was a real shock. Most of the experienced comedians, the ones that are at a very high level, had my materials. So I went there. Well, they had a performance night that they did, where they invited just a regular audience could come and see people perform. And I did a measurement on each of these using my software, each performer that went up that night. And the lowest performer generated 18 seconds of laughter on average per minute. And these people did, there's probably, I don't know, 10 people, and they did 10 minutes a piece. I mean, they were nailing it.
They're funny. And it was, you said, and they used the word Christian, so I'm assuming that this was clean comedy.
Oh, yeah, and that's something that people don't realize, is that Christian comedy is not all about Jesus and going to church and that kind of stuff. It's 95% of it is just clean comedy.
Clean, topic-based, have fun. We live, too. We have a life, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's just clean comedy. That's all I can tell you.
We've run out of time, but there's much more to come, so don't miss the next episode when we reveal more stand-up comedy secrets for beginners.